Welcome to Living Energy Day, a celebration of all things energy healing and energy psychology. Visit us at livingenergyday.com. Welcome, everyone. This is Deborah Thompson, your host of Living Energy Day. Also, I am the host of Living Energy Secrets, where we have the best and the brightest in the world of energy healing, energy psychology, and I'm thinking we're going to add the other quantum physics, because the more that we branch out, the more we find these wonderful people like our speaker front up to kick us off tonight, David Gann. I just love it. I have to tell you folks, before I even introduce you, my first conversation with Dave was, again, enrapturing. He just filled me in on more than I could possibly have read about in a book. Found out that these are quantum physicists, our engineers, are wonderful people, and they are changing our lives every single day. And with that, David Gann holds a bachelor's degree in science from UCM with postgraduate work in physics. David Gann is also the CEO, co-founder, director, and product development director for D&Y Laboratories. His scientific career spans over 30 years, and he co-founded Aquatarius LLC with Dr. Lowe, who we'll be hearing about later, and is a co-inventor and patent holder with Dr. Lowe on the company's recent patent filings, which we're going to hear what that's about. When you have these kinds of discoveries, that is the process. And I know that Dr. Lowe holds several patents. In conjunction with UCLA, Dr. Gann began his research into the detection and labeling of nano-sized particles that have been found in homeopathic solutions. And his successes, and we're going to find out why, have led to the isolating of 2-micron-sized, and I'm going to quote this, ice. It's not really ice like we think about it, like a temperature ice, but quote-unquote stable, solid water particles that were formed under electric fields versus a temperature gradient field. He's going to be talking about that. You can read the rest of his bio there on the page. And also, just to bring this up so we don't forget, we are joining with David and Dr. Lowe in helping people to understand about a study that they've got going with what we're going to hear about tonight, double helix water. It's going to be posted on several of the pages with Living Energy Day, and it may be there on the front page right now, but it's at livingenergyday.com/winter2011/study. Now, that's a long one, and so it's going to be posted everywhere. But for everyone now that's on their computer or you're on your phone line with us, then you can go to livingenergyday.com/winter2011. That's all lowercase, /study, S-T-U-D-Y. And then you're going to find out about what we're going to say. But with that, thank you, David, for joining me tonight.
Thank you, Deborah, for having me. I feel honored to be here. Exactly.
And I'm so glad that you could be with us, because I know it's kind of been last minute, and you're being the first one. I have a little bit of housekeeping to do with keeping everybody up to speed, and I am so glad that you're patient with me with that. But to get us started, I would really like you to talk a little bit about what your role has been. You were also the co-author of the Double Helix Water book, and I hope that people, when you go over to that site, you'll have a link to be able to go over and get that. But also, talk a little bit about what you talked about in your book as far as what you do, how you came to meet Dr. Lowe, and kind of just set the stage for the discovery of the incredible Double Helix Water.
I met Ian in about 1993. Ian had a project at Caltech. It was a particle beam. Yin had come from a university at Melbourne. And Yin's background, he has a long history of basically studying. He came out of the University of Chicago. That's where he did his PhD, and he did it under a man named Nabu, who went on to get the Nobel Prize. And he came with a young man named Daniel Tu, and Daniel also got the Nobel Prize. They both came out of the same high school, Ian and Daniel, and they've stayed friends all their life. And another classmate was a man who went on to become the Fields Medalist in mathematics, which is, there's no Nobel Prize given for math, but there is a Fields Medal that's a top honor. So Yin's first 20 years or so before he taught at Melbourne was just in particle physics and particle physics research. So I met Yin through some friends of mine in Los Angeles, and I had a small little company, and we were doing catalyst research. And to make a long story short, I had an individual one day give me a sample of water and said he could make a catalytic effect. Now, a catalyst is what you, like, for instance, underneath your car, you have two mufflers. One is a muffler that reduces the sound. Another muffler-looking device is called a catalytic converter. Mm-hmm. And what it does is it causes a lower combustion temperature of the fuel. So the fuel that doesn't burn inside the engine goes to the catalytic converter, and even though there's no spark there or some way to ignite the fuel, it just instantly burns in the presence of a catalyst. And so I'd done a lot of research in this area, and I was handling a problem up at Santa Barbara we had a little contract with Chevron, and they had some problems with some offshore boats, and they were smoking too much, and so we solved the problem with known catalysts. But the problem was that there's an air quality management district, which is kind of an official board in California. They came back and said, well, you can't do what you're doing because we haven't studied the catalyst that you're using. So when this man said, well, I can make you a catalyst in water, I said, well, originally from Missouri, I said, show me. And he gave me two or three samples. None of them worked. I had some large test bed engines running at that time. I couldn't see any effect, and then he asked, well, what are you using? So I showed him, and he said, well, let me have some of that. So he took some, and he brought me about three samples back, and out of the three samples, one actually had a catalyst effect. It wasn't extremely strong, but it startled me. I went, whoa, what is this guy doing?
Right, so you didn't expect that at all.
No, I didn't, and I asked him, you know, what did you do? And he wanted like $10 million to talk to me, and I said, well, you know, you got to tell me. And I knew he had no science background. He told me he had no science background. He was just kind of a backyard inventor. And I said, why? Mm-hmm. Why does this one work and these other two don't work and the other ones you gave me don't work? And he couldn't tell me. I knew Yin Lo. And Yin at that time was at Caltech. And a number of his friends were some of the top chemists in the world. I mean, there was a whole series of Sunny Chan was there and was a friend of Yin. And Alfred Wong was working on that project with us at that time, and Alfred was the clerk Maxwell Prize winner in physics and real heavyweights. And so all of a sudden
Caltech
is
heavyweight.
Oh, yeah. It's a great school.
Yes, you bet it is.
And that's where all of a sudden we started investigating this water. And first thing we did is run a whole series of analysis on it, and then turned out it was clean water. It was basically distilled water. We could find traces of this or that in it, but nothing that we knew could create a catalytic effect. We continued to test it, and we did a nuclear magnetic resonance test, which is kind of a precursor to what you have now in hospitals, and we noticed there was something different about it, and that really got us our attention, and so we just kept looking for what possibly could be in this water. Well, during this time, Yin read just everything he could get his hands on. He did a serious study. He's a serious student, and in his room, we had an office down the hall from me, and it was all blackboards. And Yin's a very serious mathematician, too. You got to remember, one of his best friends is one of the top mathematicians in the world. And so I'd go down there, and I'd see him scratching away on blackboards, and I'd go, oh, God, my math is not that strong. I'd go back, and next morning I came in, and I was having a cup of coffee, and all of a sudden he ran in, and he actually looked like a mad scientist. Hair was all kind of in disarray, and he goes, I know what it is, I know what it is, I know. I had no idea what subject we were on. I was just trying to have a cup of coffee, and I said, what? And he says, I know what's in the sample, I know what's in the sample. And I went, what's in the sample? And he says, there's a particle. He says, I've calculated it. And he said, the calculation shows that there is a water particle. And he described it to me. He described the size and the shape and how big it would grow. And so that's how it all started. And there was a man named Debye back, I think sometime in the 30s is when he got a Nobel Prize. And he wrote pretty much a definitive set of equations for what happens when you dilute something in water. And so Yen just took that, Debye's work, it's called the Debye-Huckel, I think the Debye-Huckel set of theorems. Debye had gone down to about one part in a thousand on a solution. So Yen just kept on calculating, and he found that around a one part per million, when you diluted something in water, what would happen is a particle would form. And he described the size and shape of the particle. He drew me a picture of what it would look like. And sure enough, about a year later, year and a half later, we photographed the first one using a big atomic force microscope. So it's pretty exciting. I mean, there's another phase of water. We normally think of water as we go into the refrigerator, to our kitchen, we get a glass of water. That's, mm-hmm. that's a liquid phase. And we look in the refrigerator and, yeah, in the freezer, there's some ice. Well, that's a solid phase. We put it on a stove and we heat it up. That's a vapor phase. It boils and turns to vapor. Those are the known phases of water, and they're all temperature related. There's another one above that, which is called a plasma, where you take that steam and you heat that steam up higher. But everything has to do with heat.
Right.
And this does not have to do with heat. This forms one atmosphere, and it forms at room temperature. So it is not heat related. It's related to a pressure, electrical pressure that's in the water because of the ultra low dilutions. Once a particle gets so dilute, it no longer communicates really. It's like I'm a plus and you're a minus and we talk right now. And if you were in the same room, I'd shake your hands and then the water would come between us and go, get away, get away. But I'd go across the room and I'd shake hands with another guy that's the opposite charge. And we would just continue to sort of reach out for the opposite charge. The water would push us away because it's kind of a wedge-like configuration. But what eventually happens, if you continue to dilute, that you get so far from one particle to the next that they can't communicate. They can't touch each other. And when that happens, they collapse inward. That inward collapse is caused by a force around them, which is called a Coulomb force, after a man years ago that was quite famous for many, many discoveries in electricity. But it's just, it forms a particle. And so that's sort of where it came from.
Right. And this is, like I talk to people, this is the quantum physics. And I guess when I read the book, and it is so well done, you made something that you have to have a doctorate and beyond, and the quantum physicists, as most people know, are out there on the charts of theoretical understanding of creation, of understanding even the questions to ask. This is that realm. But what you have done is bring that realm home to something that we can all go, oh, okay, you send people to space. Yeah, we have computers. Yeah, we have these things. Well, now you have a new, brand new form. Well, not brand new. You've just discovered it. A form of water. So that kind of leads us to the next thing. It's just incredible how it was made. And I really, really encourage all people that are listening to get the Double Helix Water book. And I don't remember the byline of it now. It is excellently done. In the first very small section of the first, I think it's only like 78 pages for the first part of the book, is the story, which David has so well condensed, of how they got to there and the science that's behind it and the minds that are behind it and the math that's there and what it is that Dr. Lowe discovered on his blackboard. It's incredible. It's a great story. But then, of course, the whole back part of the book, most of it is the scientific documents, the pictures, the microscopic type things, just showing what it is and then really wrapping your heads around what does this mean? What is it that we have found? The physical components, the mathematical, now we can do it again, science of this.
Well put.
And see, that's what I just thought, that it was such a great book and you did such a good job that me, I've got my little biology degree from 1977, and by the time I was done, I'm going, oh my gosh, and I'm telling everybody around me, so now other people are reading it and they're going, wow, they understand it. So you did a very good job. And
you
were very humble for yourself and Dr. Lowe. I mean, it takes about two paragraphs to mark all of what Dr. Lowe has done and the different places he's worked and his different degrees and things that he has worked on. He is highly, highly well known. And I met him and fell in love with him. He's such a sweet man. At an October bioenergetic conference where he was talking about the double helix water and demonstrating it. And on that page that you can click on to go look at that I have made, That's the one on the livingenergyday.com/winter2011/study. You'll be able to listen to an interview that I did with Dr. Low. Also, there's a transcript with it because he is of Chinese background and has an accent, and sometimes it's hard to understand. So we did make
especially when it's excited.
Oh, I'm telling you, it is so, he is so fun. And him talking about what they've discovered. And maybe you can tell a little bit, how did it go from you needing a catalyst, and I believe that the ion that you were using was platinum that works on the coking, that takes the coking off of the stacks and anything that's going to have the organic combustion junk that's stuck to everything, to get that off and how incredible that is. But how did it walk over into the biological realm?
Well, I was working with a man at UCLA, a nice guy, Salem Sinkin. He's a chairman over there of the chemical engineering department. I don't know if he is now, but at the time he was. Salem is one of the real combustion experts in the U.S., and we were working on this catalyst project. I was looking for this particle, really, in the beginning as a catalyst because it had such a large charge to it. But I also took a photograph one afternoon over at Caltech using an electron microscope because I had numerous electron microscopes in the past in different labs. And so I was taking a photograph, and I noticed all of a sudden that I was looking at a bug, just a bacterium. And I was going, wow, look at this guy's dead. There's a membrane outside these bugs, and these little water particles had ruptured that protein sac, and his guts were all over the slide. And I went, wow. I thought, well, that's why I never see any bacteria grow in this water. It's just always sterile. And I went, well, that's so interesting. I took that photograph and I showed it to Salem that afternoon, and he said, oh, come on, come on. He said, I want to go show it to this friend of mine over at the medical school. And that was a guy named Bonavide, Benjamin Bonavide. Another wonderful guy, really a sweetheart of guy. Very well published. I think he's published about 500 papers. He's mostly in cancer and AIDS research. And so he looked at it and he said, well, what is it? I said, it's a bug. And he said, oh, I know it's a bug. He says, but he says, what are these things here? And I said, well, these are little water, solid water particles, but they've got a big charge to them. And for some reason, this bug has to have a charge to him. And he's swimming around in this stuff, and it kind of just sticks to his body, and it ruptures the outside of this membrane. And that's why he's, I said, I never seen anything grow in this water, any bacteria. So he went on and said, well, I want to know what it's made of. And I said, well, this particular one, I'd used an ion, a single charge particle, a platinum ion. And we had a couple other things in there that we were holding that ion there together. There was actually an array of things, but I'd say probably the main ingredient was a platinum ion. He said, platinum is the only thing that really will stimulate T cells, but it's pretty toxic. It's not pretty toxic. It's very toxic to the body. He says, you can 50 parts per million, something like that, and you can have liver problems, all kinds of things. So he said, how much platinum is in this thing? And I said, oh, I said, you can't find any. And I said, at least.
You won't be able to find any.
Yeah, I said, at least we're down to part per billion or maybe even 10 billion or lower. I said, this is really dilute, and I said, it doesn't matter. If you control all the variables, it doesn't matter how dilute you make it, because this stuff just grows like, it grows like bacteria. And so he said, well, let's do some studies. And so I think we did 57 double-blind studies, and we found that this water particle really woke up T cells. Compared to the placebo, it was night and day that placebo would do nothing, or maybe it would do 100 responses at maximum or something like that. And this would start 3,000-4,000 and go to 7,000-8,000 responses.
And this is, T cells are very important components of the immune system.
Yeah, we were looking for a T cell to sort of wake up and to identify a bad guy and secrete a cytokine. A cytokine is kind of a, almost like a template for the line of amino acids and proteins, and to, and I would say it creates Guido. It's like an antibody goes over and Guido goes over and beats the crap out of somebody.
That's
a very simple way of putting it, but that's what we were looking for. And we just, it startled us because it was just, the stuff just exploded. It's just all of a sudden the T cells woke up and they just went back to work. So that paper was published in, I think, 96, and unbeknownst to Yen or I, we had no idea there was such a war going on between certain factions in medicine, because all of a sudden we were scoundrels and bad guys and crooks, and okay, you couldn't believe what you used to see on the internet. It was just like, I was just, you know, the most evil person on the planet, and so was Yen. it was a rough attack. It went on for many, many years.
Wow,
and
you stepped into the politics of it, huh?
Oh, boy, we stepped in. And they kept linking us back to this paper that was written in Nature back in 87 by a guy named Buenavista, who was a French researcher. He was a famous guy, actually. I think he came up with a platelet activating factor in immunology. He'd been published numerous times in Nature prior to the paper that really just sealed his fate, and that was in 87. And so they linked us to that paper and said we were just front men for people trying to push this quackery called homeopathy. There was no validity to it, no scientific evidence. Quite honestly, I admit, I didn't know what homeopathy was really at the time. I'd heard the term, but I had no clue to what the mechanism was.
It was the mid-90s before I ever heard of it. Yeah,
we were just totally shot at for stepping into this arena of some kind of ultra-low dilutions and what occurs when you dilute something many, many times in water. Even recently, we got an attack on, I think it was on Amazon, somebody gave it to me, and some guy said, oh, this is so unscientific. I went, well, you don't know science. I mean, the main paper in that book was written by a guy named Wasai Jian. It was an old colleague and friend of his named C.Y. Wong. He did his Ph.D. under Wheeler at Princeton, and Wheeler was, of course, worked with Niels Bohr and worked with Fermi, and he set up the Hanford reactor that made the material that was for the Manhattan Project, and he's no longer living, but he was a heavyweight. You know, Wheeler was a heavyweight. He worked with Oppenheimer and those guys, because really particle physics in the past has just been mostly involved in weaponry, because it was really how the physical universe worked. But Yin just always wanted to, you meet Yin and you look at the guy and you go, this guy's not into weapon science. He's into understanding what's going to work to help to create a better world.
Oh, yes, to solve the real problems that people here are dealing with on this planet, some of them that are just there and some of them that are caused by other men who have come up with things that now we have to fix. And one of those being, what are we going to do with all the wasted fission fuel?
Yeah, we have tons of that fuel sitting around. People don't realize how much there is.
Yeah.
And the U.S. has, you know, just rods from the reactors that are around the U.S. We have probably 250 ponds. And those ponds have to be cooled constantly. And all we have to do is lose power for a little while, and then the generators turn on. And then when that diesel runs out, those things become basically Chernobyl. Mm-hmm. So they come, the same thing that happened in Japan. They'll heat up and they'll blow up. So it's something that we really need to look at and confront.
And the only reason we mention that, we digress to that, is that that is one of the things I know that Dr. Lowe had worked on when he was in Australia. And you talk about that in the book, that he is the owner of many patents for doing fusion energy to solve these problems. And that's why I even am going to keep my little quip here, you know, support your local quantum physicist, you know, because these are the kind of problems we need to take care of. But then in another little turn in his life, then you got to the stable water and stepped into the politics and the money of medical things, of drugs. How are we going to fix this? How are we going to take care of it when people need antibiotics? And, of course, I hope we have a chance, just because I know we've got so much to cover in so little time, to talk about even what you're looking further. But now that you have the stable water clusters, they're not ice. I mean, that's the easiest way to describe it, I suppose, but it isn't temperature ice. Like you say, it's the energetic ice, I guess you could say.
It's really not an ice particle, because we speak of ice as something that's cold. This is not necessarily cooled. It's just a new configuration of water.
Right.
And we feel, although we can't prove yet, but we intuitively feel that it is a natural process in our body. And so consequently, Yin, not only did he do a degree in particle physics, he also, a number of years ago, began studying Chinese medicine. And he feels that this water particle is what the Chinese has been looking for about 3,000 years, or a little longer than that. And that is that it's a material basis for these things called meridian. Meridians are, it's sort of an electrical system that's senior to all other systems in the body. There's a balanced flow of energy going through these meridians. A person's well, where there's a blockage or there's something happening or there's something wrong in the body, then there'll be a stoppage of energy flowing. And so Ian's pretty convinced of this now, and he's done a lot of work in the last two or three years. We've looked at a ton of thermal images. We'll have a person come in and we'll do a thermal image, and what we're looking at is just a heat signature of the body. And the guy complained whether he's got a bad shoulder, he's got a bad, he's had a prostate operation, he's had this or that, and you'll see that on these thermal images because that area will just be white hot. It's amazing when you give this guy a glass of this water, just a 5 or 6 drops or 10 drops at max in a glass of water, and a glass of distilled water, and have him drink that, and watch what occurs with that inflammation. That temperature just drops dramatically. This is almost completely consistent. There's always change. We've had some people heat up, very few, and normally we find that they have something going on. But for the most part, people will dramatically cool down. And there's some of those pictures in the Double Helix water book. Interesting picture, and there's a friend of mine that's become a close friend because of the last 3 or 4 years of taking this water. He had prostate cancer. So the treatment they used on him was to embed a radioactive pellet in next to his prostate, next to the cancer.
Right.
Of course, that killed the cancer, but also really caused a lot of problems in his urinary tract.
And right, in normal tissue.
It just couldn't urinate, and it was just like he was on different kinds of medications to help him go to the bathroom. And he met me in 3 or 4 years ago, and I said, well, you should try some water. You know, in a few weeks, he called me and says, you know, I've cut down my medication significantly, and he says, I'm not having any problem. And then within a couple of more weeks, he was off of it, and that's been like 3 years now. He's not had any more medication, and he has no problem urinating. His body has healed is what's happened.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing about this. I always want to be careful to say, you know, this is not a drug. It's not, Yin and I are not MDs, although we've got tons of MDs working with us, but we're not MDs. Our background is strictly physics. But the reality is this Double Helix water does not appear to be any kind of disease-specific. If I could classify it in any sense, I'd almost like classify it as an immune trigger. Yin says, well, no, it's part of the meridian. That's why people get
energy.
Well.
Okay.
Yeah, it could be. But we know it's a particle. I know tons about the particle. I know how to make the particle. I know where it comes from. I've analyzed it for 15, 18 years now. I know when you concentrate it, you get it in strong concentrations, it forms double helixes, just like DNA. When I see that DNA double helix structure, I go, wow, is this a precursor to nucleic acid?
Mm-hmm.
Because or an amino acid. Is it one of the simplest amino acids is it's an OH, and then it has a tail on it, which is a carbon, and it's got a tail, another one on it that's nitrogen. So it's just a hydroxyl with a carbon and a nitrogen. And I go, well, you know, this is H2O, so how could it lose one of those H's? And I go, well, I think I know how it loses that H. And so we've got a lot of research planned right now to see if we're sitting on something which is a total fundamental of the body. It's like billions of years ago when protoplasm started. It had to have started from, you know, the planet was water. People say, well, it's got water. You know, how did the life jump? Did somebody come along and see the water or something? Or no, I think probably just, reading my book, it explained very simply how something like that could have happened to where you've got water. Water goes through a phase change from liquid to vapor and just with sunlight. Of course, there's lots of contaminants in the air, but you only need a microsecond for this to occur. You need a sharp change of electrical pressure, and boom, you've got something to start.
Now, when keep saying double helix, and that's the structure, just wrapping our heads around that, when we think of an ice cube, as the water cools and it gets colder and colder and colder, the atoms, you know, the HTO begins to arrange itself in that rectangular crystalline structure or whatever it looks like under the microscope. But what you're saying with this new phase, as it immediately goes into this new phase of solid water, that when this propagation of more and more and more of the water goes from the liquid state into this collapsed clusters state. As the clusters are forming, what you're saying is that they form in the double helix pattern?
Yeah, because if you look at the smallest geometry, it only has a certain way it can bond. In the book, I describe it, if you're building a brick house or a chimney or something like that, it's however you start those first bricks, it's always going to have that particular shape to it. When these particles bond, they have certain bonding areas on them, and they look like a little bit like a little soccer ball. They'll always bond in a helix structure. That's why it's very suspicious when you see it. You go, well, you know, why is it bonding in a helix structure? And now these nitwits are saying this. They found the essence of life. Now we're really going to get shot. But
there you go. Look out. Put the big, huge bullseye right on your chest.
Yeah.
So, but did you find, or do you think, or is there any sort of evidence that you've come up to so far that living beings, it's going on in their system that really there is a point where the double helix water form is already there in our system?
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, that's some work that we're doing right now. We've got some pretty exciting things going on right now that I'd love to talk about them, but from a viewpoint of a little company, we have to patent something so we can get some money somehow to keep this research going. But the reality is, I think this particle exists in all life forms, and I think it exists in all plant forms. It has a, you know, I have some plants in my living room here that just look beautiful, and they've got a lot of big flowers on them, and I use this water on them, and I've got some other friends doing that now, and they're going, my God, you can't believe how nice my plants look. And the same thing with dogs, cats, fish. A vet down in Florida told me about this dog, and she told me about a bunch of dogs, but she had one particular dog that had a really serious situation and a big tumor on the side of his face, and it was eaten into the bone, and dog was just giving up, wasn't going to live, and so wouldn't open its mouth to eat because it was too painful. And she just kind of used an eyedropper and put just the straight double helix water in his mouth for a couple of days, and all of a sudden the dog finally opened his mouth, started eating, and in 8 weeks the tumor was completely gone, and she had did nothing except just use the water on him. The thing is that I think all life forms have this basic,
it's a
fundamental particle, and I think it's the original sort of direction, intention, and vector of where it all started. Because to me, life must have began by something coming together. I mean, I think it's pretty much agreed it started in water. So what could then have happened? We talk about, well, it must have been ammonia or something like that. Well, I think it was water, because even today, you know, we look at our bodies, we're not 70% ammonia.
Ammonia, right.
you know, we're 70% water or more. Our blood's about 90% water. The first structures would have been nothing but, I believe, these particles, and they had a direction and a flow to them. And that direction and flow or vector was to find another particle and combine with that particle. And that particle becomes larger, and it finds another particle and gets larger, gets bigger charge, keeps moving. And that almost becomes like the original intention is like to survive. It's like we find that in just all life forms, that their biggest thing they're trying to do is to continue, to procreate, to survive, to get better. And I think that probably started with just a direction and a flow of a little tiny water particle. I'm sure I'm going to get shot with that theory.
Well,
but
you are
but I think it has
a
lot
of, this is a group
it's
of people
got
that
some validity
it.
To it.
Now, how to come down to a little bit more rubber meets the road, tell us a little bit, how did you folks get started with working with people with autism? Talk about that, what difference it makes. I know that the thermographs are being used just to show people the difference, like you're talking about. We did that in North Carolina, and on that page, which is now linked, if you go to the About page on our livingenergyday.com, you'll see the link to my page, and you'll see a couple of those thermographs there. And I will be maintaining the page that I put up, and as we get more and more of the thermographs from other people that have gone through and done the protocol, which I have described, and I don't want to take time to do that, on the page that I put up, it's just extremely interesting, and we don't have time. I know there's so many things that you could tell us about what you guys have just decided to try the water with. Talk about how you got into autism, and then we'll go and talk about the study.
Well, real quickly, I met a man about 4 years ago in Los Angeles. I was out in Los Angeles as an looking for investors, and some people put together an investor meeting one night. And I looked across the room, and all these huge, tall guys were over in the corner. And I went, "Oh, these guys got to be former basketball players because they were all like 6'8". One guy probably was 7'2", and I recognized a couple of them. And I went, "Oh, these are all Lakers." And so went over and started talking with them. And there was a gentleman there. His name was Ernie Vanderway. And Ernie had been the MD to the Lakers for, 25, 30 years, something like that.
Oh, okay.
And had taught at UCLA, and he taught pediatrics. And Ernie had some skin cancer problems. And he said, "You know, will this water help my skin cancers?" And I said, "You know, don't have a clue."
Who
I said, "Here, here, take some water and find out." Well, you know, long story short, his skin cancers disappeared. And so about, 6-8 months later, he called me and said, "I'm going to give some of this water to, I have an acquaintance, about a 5-year-old boy that's autistic." And he said, "I want to give him that water, and I want to see if it makes any change." And he says, "What do you think?" And I said, "I know it won't hurt him because of the water particle, but I said, I don't know if it's going to help him or not." But anyway, long story short, too, the kid's in public school now. A year or so later, he goes from, according to Ernie, full-blown autistic child to now he's a year or so later, he's in public school. He's doing extremely well. The teachers love him. He says he's extremely bright. And then from there, we started meeting other people that had autistic children. We just found that they all, about 85% of the kids, were remarkably improving. That little boy that was 12 or 13 at the time started taking the water had never talked to his parents, never looked, because the characteristic of autism is no eye contact. Well, their eyes are going all over the place, and they'll make no eye contact with you all. And, mother called me not long ago, and she's in tears. She says, "He's sitting on my lap, and she says, "He's talking to me, he's like he's starting to be verbal." I go, "Whoa, boy." It's just a big change with these kids. I mean, one thing that we find hard to do is handle all the emotion from the mothers. They see such changes in their kids.
Well, and the parents are stressed out to start with because, depending on the scale of autism, there is a lot of different things that could be occurring, and there's so much that has to be done 24/7. And I know that we're going to have other people that are going to be speaking with us this whole day. We've asked people to kind of address a little bit about the autism as they go through. And many of them have said, if you can get the parents de-stressed and calmed down, that's going to help the autistic child to begin with. That's
That's probably very, very true.
Yeah, working with the kids.
It's got to be some kind of toxicity effect. I think that we're seeing a rise in autism because we've created about 100,000 new chemicals in the last 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
And this next generation is getting weaker, and the following generation is going to get even weaker because in a cell you've got all these little organelles that sort of fix things. You've got a degree in biology. So you know what I'm talking about. They're basically, but in the main part of the cell is where DNA must divide. And it's in a double helix spiral, and it's got to twist itself apart, and then it's got to pull itself apart. And then you've got all these areas that need to rebond with a like particle, in other words, a nucleic acid. And then it's going to fold itself back up, and the new cell is born. Well, that happens in a soup, and that soup should be filled with nucleic acids and amino acids, and it's just the protoplasm of the cell. But I think what's happening now is we have a ton of other almost garbage in those cells, stuff that their cells are not familiar with because they've existed for some 3 billion years or more, and they've never run into, a food coloring that makes milk look chocolatey or a
face alien molecule.
Just a foreign molecule. I think Linus Pauling said it best back in the 70s. He just said that, you'll never solve problems with a toxic molecule because the body's just not going to know what to do with it. I think we've just created too many toxins in our life, in our air, in our water, in our food. And
that doesn't even include the electromagnetic.
Yeah, and that's another big thing that's happening
from
is
everything electrical and everything, you know, radio, and I don't even know all those things because I don't have an engineering or physics degree. You know, we're just bombarded with all of this, and I don't want to take too much time, but I know we're about to run out of time, and I wanted to ask you some specifics about the study that you've done. I know that when you had the kids coming into the clinic, you were taking the thermographs, and was there something that autistic children normally show in those thermographs so that you could immediately see a difference when they had the water or the cream?
Well, this is more Yin's area now, but yes, the thermal images that we see hot spots. And then Yin has come back numerous times and said, look, these hot spots, and he'll show them to me. He says, these are the yang meridians, for instance, in the head. And he'll say, this is the bladder, and this is the gallbladder, and he'll the stomach, and he'll show them to me, and he'll point them out. They're very consistent with autistic children, and there is change when they drink this water. And the kids themselves, after a while, ask for the water. They want more water. Everybody, we all know if we're getting better or not. And I think Yin has a paper coming out just in the next, I think it's, we publish in the next month or so. It's a Journal of Chinese Medicine. He's come up with, he believes, a way to diagnose autism at a very early age. And the thing is, at a very early age, it should be very correctable. You should be able to correct it very quickly with this water because it has such a large electrical potential to it. I mean, it is a polar particle. And this appears to be some type of a developmental illness where there's missing information from the DNA this kid's trying to grow off of. Mm-hmm. And he's, for some reason, certain areas are not developing. And a big area is how he thinks and how he communicates. Because if you notice, autistic children is, they're the most frustrated kids in the world. They want to say something. They want something. They look across the room and they want that banana or that candy bar or something, but they try to say that, but I'm sure something else is coming to their head, and they never quite get it out, and then they get so frustrated, and they're I've been around kids that I just go, wow, that's the most frustrated kid in the world, but they calm down. They just calm down, and they become less and less frustrated. So that must mean that there is some healing mechanism going on.
Or some energy, I don't want to say rerouting, but something that is being corrected in how the general overall communication is happening cell to cell, and then, of course, within the meridians and the relays in the brain that have to gate all of this stuff between the brain and the heart and the pictures between the before and after, and we're only talking like a half an hour between pictures and taking these things. And I want to be sure to leave people with this study information, which is www.joinautismstudy.net. So that's www.joinautismstudy.net. They are in the whole time now when they're redoing their websites, and I've talked to several people there, especially with Kathy, and they have hired someone that's coming in and redoing the websites, redoing some of the explanations. And if people have a chance to go to the page that I created, you'll be able to listen to the interview that I did with Dr. Lowe and see the transcript, go and be able to look at what the study is. And it's all being done on the Internet. And what he's so excited about is before you can get to the point where they're going to invest all the time and all the money and all the heavy, heavy, heavy science backgrounds to do trials on this double helix rotter, they have to demonstrate efficacy at this point, especially when you're talking alternative because you stepped into the politics and the money of it. When you're talking anything like this, which is cheap, I mean, it's pretty cheap when you're talking about what it does, and it's fairly easy made now that you guys have done all the hard labor. They really would like to get 10,000 plus. They really need that many different studies, and it only takes, I think it's 60 days that you would be involved in the study, and the caregivers, parents, guardians would be doing the water and then writing out all the information and changes, what's happening, you know, just putting the information in that they have. But they really need to get 10,000 plus people involved in the study to be able to go out, then do the fundraising, do the things you have to do to get the big trials done.
Yeah, it should be. I mean, this is something that everybody can get involved in. And it's simple water, and the water is really, we've gotten it now to where it's not expensive at all. It used to take me, you know, half hour to make a tiny little bottle of it in a clean room with a friend of Yen and my friend also. He was here for about a year or so. He was the former chairman of physics at Sun Yat-sen in China. He spent a year with me, and now we've got a manufacturing process, and we can make tons of it. And so you can get a hold of the water. The water's inexpensive. Just get involved in that study. It would be a great thing to do.
Please do that. And we have contacted, and Mike Broadwell, of course, has done a fabulous job at organizing this and has talked to many different people who have contacts into the autism world with different groups, and they're just, it's just wonderful. And so just kind of doing the networking and getting it out there. And I wanted to say that also on that page, you can get a link to where you can do more study about the water. And of course, all these pages are in the process of being remade. So if you happen to click and it doesn't work quite right one day, don't worry about it.
It should be up the next day or so. The website, the Double Helix Water. So it's Double Helix Water. That's the website. But if you can't get through on that, there's an 800 number, which you can always call, and that's the Cobalt Group.
Oh, yes, and that website is cobalt-distribution.com. And I just happened to know when you recognized that, I said, oh, okay, because I've ordered it. I use it myself. And so I was just going to say cobalt-distribution.com, and that's www. And, yeah, go ahead with the 800 number.
It's 800-270-8650. 800-270-8650. So anyway, if you call that number, you know, they can get you water, and it can also lead you to get you on the study.
Right.
You know, that's the kind of the story of where we are right now.
It's so exciting. And folks, you are on the ground floor of being a part of something that is brand new, at least out to public now, brand new, groundbreaking, and I'm so thrilled for you to keep us up to date on where you're at with your new studies and the new theories, that it's just absolutely amazing that the theory could be that you have just discovered the precursor to DNA. You know, and this is something that all life forms have to have. It's exciting. It makes me tingle. Here we are, 2011, and you could be a part of it. Well, I know that it is about 4 minutes to the next hour, and we need to give up the line, David. And thank you so much, because we've got Kathy Vartuli and Rick Wilkes up next, and everyone's going to be excited to hear from them, two of my favorite people, EFT, energy psychology, and they use the kinds of things you work on.
I'm sure they do.
And they're both science majors themselves, so I hope that they've been loving what you've been talking about.
Excellent.
That's exciting. Good night, David.
Good night. And so thank you very much. And so then I turn it over to Kathy now. Okay,
Kathy,
thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Bye-bye.
That was great.
Bye.